I love the fact that every time we start an episode, I do a 3, 2, 1, and then hit record, completely forgetting that Zencaster does its own 3, 2, 1 countdown, and it completely throws my timing off. Yeah,
You got this, buddy.
I totally know what I'm doing, eh? You 75 episodes, I know what I'm doing. Somewhat.
I'm glad one of us does.
It's a low bar. That is a low bar. Okay, so you are listening to the Micro Machines podcast. This week we have a very special guest with us, a fellow Kiwi, David Mulder. He has been he is currently revamping a couple of model stores here in New Zealand, and something that I am very, very excited about. But before we get into that, we are going to have our usual round of introductions. So, first off, you have me, Callum, coming in from New Zealand, currently absolutely sweating because it is about 30 degrees in my house and I have no air conditioning at all. Garrison?
Well, you got me, Garrison, out here in Kansas with new house with great insulation and AC. Callum, drinking a white Monster. And ready for this episode, guys.
Clint?
Hey, you got me, Clint, in Indiana. It is very nice and toasty in my house since we're on the other side of the world and in winter at the moment. And I have myself a nice Arnold Palmer.
Nice.
And if our special guest could introduce himself.
Hey, g'day, I'm David Mulder. Currently running Northland Hobby, and recently acquired the Model Air down in Auckland.
Sweet. All right. So the reason I have got David onto the episode is, first off, just on Facebook, going through all the New Zealand Facebook groups, a post from a store that I visit quite a lot, Model Air, suddenly came up, and that post was the original owner, Richard, wasn't it?
Yes,
Richard. Richard owned it. And he suddenly, somewhat out of the blue, put up this post. Hey, who wants a model store?
Oh, hang on. That's Mark Robson, actually.
Oh, shit.
It was Richard very, very originally. And then up until 15 or so years ago, Mark Robson.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah.
No worries.
I can edit stuff out.
What?
keep that in. Keep that in.
Oh, that makes me look like a complete dickhead. No, they're staying in. anyway, so yeah, this post comes up on the Model Air Facebook page, going, does anyone want a model shop? Because the owner, who also owns Qatari and various other things, just couldn't support Model Air anymore. Model Air was, I will say, being a Patreon there, was on a downturn. They were only open on weekends at certain times. The stock was running out, very small, in my opinion. Like a lot of stuff was on the shelves that had been on the shelves for the last 5 years or so and hadn't moved.
Yeah,
from what I noticed, and yeah, it was kind of watching Model Air in a sort of death throes, I hate to say, and it was very sad for me because it is one of my favorite stores. It is very close to my work, which is, you know, very good for me because I might go off and have an extended lunch browsing around. But yeah. Anyways, so this post comes up saying, who wants a model store? You just take over the lease and the stock and all of that. And, I mean, for me personally, I thought about it a lot, do I want to change jobs? Do I want to own my own model store and have all of that? But for me, it's not feasible. And next thing I know, there is another post. Someone else has taken over Model Air. And of course, it is David. So, David, why did you take over Model Air?
So I'm just going to segue back quickly to the sadness of, the brand of Model Air.
Go for it.
It's been around for 93 years.
Yeah, New Zealand's oldest model shop?
Oldest by far.
Yeah.
So, yeah, in 7 years' time, it's going to turn to a Centurion. So, it's very important that the brand is kept alive. You know, for me, that's wholly part of the way, you know, I was more than glad to, you know, be the new shepherd for it. And that's how I feel, you know, because it does have a lot of history, and a lot of the guys around New Zealand, you know very well and have been brought up by the store. So I know Mark a little bit, and through some of his network and so forth, he'd managed to see what I'd done previously with Northland Hobby. So this used to be up here in Whangarei, the old one-stop model and hobby store. And so very much in the same state that Model Air was. So old dusty kits that new stock never came into. It had an additional dimension, though, of toys. So there was, like, bath bomb kits in here and everything. So the old owner was just trying to sell whatever to, you know, make it still a relevant retail store. And so when I took over this, you know, it needed a massive change, and that's along what we're going to see with Model M. Now, the reason I've taken it over, because I'd only recently taken over the Northland Hobby, the Whangarei store, within the last 3 months. And so, yeah, it was very, there's a lot of risk going on right now, as you can imagine, a lot of risk, but that's fine. Because realistically, what the hobby store needs is a revitalization. And I get even endless amounts of customers up here saying, you know, there's a lot of these stores are not really existing anymore. And I say, oh, yeah, that's true, but you know, we can't just sell boxes anymore. And that's true for a lot of retail stores. And so, you know, we do a lot of, you know, the revitalization into the community spaces, and Model Air is a fantastic starting point for a lot of that. It has a huge inbuilt fan base. You know, just alone posting one thing on Facebook gets, you know, 1,000 impressions within hours. Yeah, and so you can see that, like, it's just waiting there for this uplift to take place. And for me, I've got this opportunity now. You know, I know the industry, I know a lot of what's what works and what doesn't. And so I feel in that at least I'm in the right place, you know, to guide Model Air forward and, you know, let's reach this 100 years.
Yeah, hopefully, because... like, what's your background with working with, say, stores and stuff like that? Is like you've got a background in, say, retail specifically, or and it's just like mixing it with your hobby, or?
Yeah, so about 10 years ago, I was in retail for about 5 years. And during that time, I earned several qualifications in retail management and did a lot of IT stuff. And so I've got a lot of that background. Up until recently, I was in IT management at an international level. And so that doesn't make much sense, but you know, doing the hobby, knowing my back-end skills, you know, you kind of think, you know, this can be something. Because what we find in, you know, a lot of the guys that are in the retail, in these hobby retail stores, they're not retail guys first. So, you know, they don't have any of that retail skill. When you talk about upsell, cross sell, margin, you know, those are foreign words to them. And it shouldn't be.
And also customer service.
Customer service.
Yeah. I remember when I first got back into the hobby, my sister went into Model Air, because even she knew the name Model Air, and she questioned herself on that one. But, you know, so she went in and she was trying to just find something, and she didn't really know, she doesn't know anything about models. She was just trying to find me something for Christmas.
Yeah.
And she asked for help and all that. And the guy there was, she said it in much stronger words, but basically he was a bit hostile and a bit, didn't really want to help out, didn't, you know, kind of just a bit dismissive. And yeah, so she had she had a lot of words about that. And it's kind of, yeah, for me, it's a bit disheartening of like, you know, even if someone's going in to find a present for a modeler, you should be able to help out someone find something for someone else and, you know, not find it like an annoyance or something like that. It's
Exactly. And so there's a huge gap in the market for model stores around this. You know, they just don't offer that level. And so, like I said, there's opportunity for us going forward with the skills. You know, we have things like sales lines and how do we approach customers and things like that. Like foreign, again, many foreign kind of things that don't exist in the older style retail, the old style hobby stores. And, you know, finding the right kind of personality. So, you know, going forward, getting the right manager into Model M is very important for me.
Yeah. And, of course, there's also the other side of retail, which is marketing as well. Mm. You know, you can't just exist as a store nowadays, especially now that you've got the internet, you've got your own YouTube page for Northland. And you've also started your own podcast for that. Yeah, you've got Facebook pages where you can post videos of updates and stock and stuff like that. So there's all these brand new avenues for marketing nowadays, whereas, you know, a lot of the older model stores just don't do that nowadays. They kind of just try and rely on their own reputation or, you know, word of mouth or something like that.
Exactly. And like, you know, and even like the social media does need the ramp up, you know, and so with us, because it's, you know, me at the forefront, we can try things, change things, cut it out. You know, when you see even some of the other, I wouldn't say older hobby stores, but even just the hobby stores that have come up in recent years, their Facebook posts extend to just, you know, this pile of product that's coming and that's about it. And so, yeah, making sure we have, you know, all the social media, we're talking, you know, short form videos, long form videos, getting community focused, talking to the interesting people around our hobby, talking directly to the groups, and getting very, very involved with that. You know, so one thing that we do offer, because I do come from a little bit of a wargaming background as well, is obviously, you know, having tables in store. Like, why do you do that? Well, you like to sit and yarn to people and talk about their hobby is very important to them. You know, and even though these older guys in these hobby stores were hobbyists, you know, getting them to have a good yarn about the hobby was still a very foreign activity.
Yeah. And also, the longer you can keep someone in a hobby store, the more they're going to spend as well.
Exactly.
I mean,
exactly.
I know I have to speed run through it because I'm just like, just you're going in for one thing only, and get out.
That's always been the plan, but it never happens.
Oh, yeah, totally. It's like I go in to pay $5 and I walk away minus 50.
Exactly. Yeah. So again, you know, we're able to, you know, bring in the products, you know, different new products that we like, and start having conversations about them with those people, you know. But it's just, you know, more standard retail techniques that really just didn't exist in these hobby stores, you know. Oh, look, here's something new. That's our hero product. We talk about it and we show the customers and they go, wow, I didn't know that existed. And, you know, it turns into real sales, you know, whereas, you know, again, just not being connected with the customers and changing that. And it's massive, you know, you've got to be these days because we are dealing with here, you know, online stores that can sell it cheaper than you. And you should make sure that you're offering that extra bit, you know.
Yeah, totally. Because I think it's also like good social media side to have a face of the store sort of thing. So like for you, you do these you know, these videos showing off new stuff, all you're updating people of new stuff you're doing, but you're in the video itself. It's a bit like, you know Andy Klein over in Arizona, Andy's Hobby Headquarters.
Oh yes, yeah.
That's one thing he did, you know, back in the day when he was a lot smaller and he started doing videos and people started liking it. Now he's, you know, recognized throughout the state. So he's now like, if you're driving through Arizona, you have to stop at his store, and people know him and, you know him by face and stuff. So I think it's very important, especially if you're going to have that sort of loyalty as well, to have a face of the store. You know,
yeah,
it's like, this is me, this is my store, this is what I offer you, come in, have a look, sort of thing, you know.
Absolutely. And it's not like you're building a cult of personality, you know. You're just saying, you know, and this is very important, like you're saying, you know, we're local, we're your people, we don't forget about you. And, you know, those kind of triggers, you know, make people's brains tick over differently when it comes to it. And it does mean, oh, yeah, they say lines like, oh, yeah, you know, I do want to spend that money with you rather than going to the box store, rather than going to online. And you involve yourself with groups. You do the videos, but, you know, you show up as well. So everything that we do in store, where you try to say, you know, with the groups, you know, get involved with the store as well. We'll help here and here and there, you know, come and have your meetings in store if you need to. And, you know, we offer that space. We offer the ability to, you know, talk shop. And then, you know, it's evolved now to where we have days where particular people just show up from a group, and all of a sudden it's half of a club meeting in store that they're having. And it's just fantastic to see, because, you know, they'll stay in here for half an hour just yarning to each other, building community. People see that, and it really pays dividends, because now you're seeing, you know, a lot of energy within the store. And, you know, everything that we previously had, you can't just walk and buy a box and walk out. Like, you need the energy. It builds it up. People stay a bit longer, have a look at different things that are around. Otherwise, you know, people just walk in, check the box sets, check the sales tables, and they're out. That's it.
Yeah, yeah, totally. So speaking of, like, say, groups and stuff like that, because we have the Auckland IPMS Club, are you going to, say, you know, approach them and to say, like, hey, we've got this revamp, and, like, sort of work with modeling groups within Auckland? Or
Yeah, IPMS is going to be quite a hard one to get through. As far as I've seen, which is very sad, is that it's mostly drifted away. Again, this is not kind of pre-talked about this a little bit before the podcast. You know, a lot of these groups, if you have a bad retail store and bad people in the retail store, it's not just, you know, the retail side that suffers. You know, these groups now start shopping online. They start disassociating physically because of that. You know, why would you want to now go somewhere? The store doesn't offer anything. There's not really anyone to talk to. And it just makes a massive dysfunction of the scene, just because, you know, just because of a bad retail store. And that's the reality of it. So I've talked to IPMS and see what kind of shape they're in and go from there, really. But, you know, those groups, they need the revitalization. It happened very much up here when I reconnected with the Whangarei Model Association. And so, you know, the group's been growing, where they meet in store, and just people are coming back to it. We're starting to get younger members. There's so many little key points that, you know, just need to be rebuilt. And it's all because of these reasons, bad retail stores.
Yeah. Well, I can tell you now, for the Auckland IPMS, I am a member of the club. So if you need a hand, I can easily, you know, whip them into submission if you want. I'll make some changes. Don't worry about that.
Good.
So a little sort of behind the scenes thing, when you, because I saw recently you posted you got some brand new stock in Model Air, which I need to go in and have a look desperately. So being in New Zealand, we were kind of the last stop for, you know, postage and stuff like that. How difficult is it to actually get new stuff in? Because I know we don't get too much in the way of, like, brand new stuff. Say, Copper State Models, for an example, plasticmodels.co.nz got in a whole bunch of Copper State Model World War One armored cars. and word got around through the Facebook groups, and they sold out within a week or so. So, like, how difficult is it to get like that sort of new stuff into New Zealand?
Look, it's exceptionally difficult. Me and my partner actually spend like a lot of time trying to figure out how we go about getting brands. And again, because we're light on the ground, we can quickly make changes. This distributor is not really working for us. Okay, what can we do? We can push in another direction, turn the ship. And so it's not easy at all. And we're not even talking about, the smaller brands like that. We're talking about even the large brands. It's very hard work, but it's not impossible. And it's realistically finding just the right people to work with. Again, there's a lot of people around, a lot of people in the hobby scene, the back-end distributors and so forth, that, are actually in the same kind of state that these hobby shop employees and owners are in. And so, we can change direction, find someone else, work really hard at that back end and constantly change. And so for us, it's very important that we are, A, on top of obviously what's coming out new, but B, looking at every single avenue and having a good base of people in the back as well from the different hobby clubs and so forth that are actually quite knowledgeable, not only, of what is new, but what people like and so forth. And so, keep our ear close to the ground. But then, there's also other avenues which we go down. So, a lot of what we're having issues with, what you've said about trying to get just the, basic kits in, it's tenfold that for trying to get wargaming stuff in. Exceptionally difficult. And so, we've now got a bank of 3D printers at our store, 6K ones, a resin 6K printers. So for the ability for us to move again in a different direction, and we've got to be constant and live and move with whatever we can deal with in front of us. And things like 3D printers are going to be very important, especially for countries like us, well out of the way of often the direct manufacturer's mines, which there's nothing we can do in most cases. But now we have different avenues where we can say, well, actually, it's just a matter of it actually comes to this weird philosophy, back in the 70s and 80s, where you've got the start of, Games Workshop and the start of Battlefront miniatures, where, there you get a bunch of sculptors and a retail store together. They're all getting quite annoyed with the availability of stuff. So it's, it's swings and roundabouts again. And so, we've got a partnered sculptor under Flytrap Digital, shout out Anton. And we're looking at what we do going forward concerning miniatures, because we're in the same place again, but we're in a new world, new technology. And we'll find different avenues to restart the world, even though those constraints exist, there's always going to be a way forward. And so finding those and being reactive to them is very important for us.
That's great. I love that. When you mentioned 3D printers, I do remember going through the Northland Facebook group. You mentioned you have a 3D printing division, as you mentioned just before. So what I was curious about how that's going to go forward. You're saying printing stuff off. Is that going to be like, say, on demand? Is that going to be a set of stuff that you have the STLs for? Or is that like, say, if someone has a whole bunch of STL files, they want to print something off, they can come to you and say, hey, can you print these off for me and help us out with that? Sort of like a support desk at the same time. Is that something that you'll be looking at going forward?
Yeah, so we've started the customer. We've started the customer printing to start with. So, bring your file and we'll print it. Here's like a basic price list of what a 28 millimeter miniature will cost compared to a 172 or a 135. And then we have our print on demand sculpt partner, Flytrap Digital. And so with him, what we do is, we say, well, we have high fidelity sculpts from Anton from Flytrap, and we have three direct scales that we can print these in. We optimize everything, we go through it, and then from there it's print on demand. We have a cabinet that we fill of the three scales available. And then, we're not shy if someone wanted to talk to us about, something, a different scale again, especially for these high fidelity miniatures that Flytrap does. It's easy enough for us to go, oh, well, just spend a bit more time and see if we can support it correctly and get it on the build plate, So it's very easy for us to do. And it does mean that we, start dedicating, at least for now, myself, to the back end of printing and getting the quality right and making sure that copies across. And then we start, because it's realistically, it is two-pronged where we have the front room, back room, three-pronged with the social media, actually. And so we have a different way of approaching, new product, prints. Sorry, probably rambling. Getting back to the question, we team up with the sculptor. We have the on demand, him and I sit down and really go through. We're not just looking at the 3D print files in a traditional sense of here's a million bits that can be printed. We're like, no, well, actually, we need to think about how we bring these to the forefront of retail. So, you want specific SKUs and packets and so forth to make sure that, A, you can actually barcode things and count them, but, B, make sure that it is in an affordable state so that someone can look at a pack and say, well, that all makes sense. There's not a million things to think about when it comes to a print. We're all familiar with some of the STLs we've seen. It's like, oh, look at this STL, and it's a million bits for one miniature.
Yes.
We can't present a box like that. But also, it's not like a sprue. So, we have to change the world up and how we approach printable files as well to make sure they're in that retailable space. Skew the products appropriately and work very hard with the sculptor. Because it's like, before it was like, oh, well, this works really well for print files, for STLs. Oh, but that actually doesn't. For instance, the sculptor and I have been talking, well, what does a full miniature look like compared to a componentized miniature? And do we want to do a million components or kind of tidy it up, make sure that it just prints really well and becomes a retailable option? And so there's a lot of back-end work. It's not just, oh, yeah, we'll get the files and print them. And even though we do that for customers, at the end of the day, when we want, the best of the best kind of out of our 3D printers, we want to make sure that, that thought of how does it sell really be at the forefront of our mind, the sculptor's mind. And this is very world, new world stuff that we're talking about here.
Hey, that is what we're all about, Our podcast, we are definitely looking at the younger sort of up and coming generation, looking at brand new ideas within the hobby sort of thing. So, the whole 3D printing side of thing is, for us, great. Talking about the whole, we can't get aftermarket in New Zealand is almost non-existent. like me, myself, I went out and bought myself a 3D printer just for doing that kind of stuff, because I, you know, people say, oh, just, you know, just order it from Australia and bring it in. And I'm sitting there going, yeah, that's half the cost of the what I'm buying is just trying to get it over to New Zealand. You know, you got B&A, but it's like, yeah, that's great, but it's expensive. You know, so
Exactly. And like, you know, at the end of the day, you know, it's actually not hard to do resin casting. It's hard to get the three ups and that design work really down. And so at least 3D printers do cut off having to go through the mass production side of things. But yeah, when you're talking about now putting into mass production, yeah, everything's got to change and so forth, because the ability's there, but it's all got to be, you know, reimagined. The whole 3D side of the business, you know, we're not just some printers. You know, there's a large undertaking there to go on around, you know, getting that into that space where, you know, the standard consumer is saying, well, I actually do need this and I do need that. And we say, well, that's great. And we can offer you, you know, a solution in a retailable sense, yeah, and a box sense, rather than having to go through the pain of, you know, either getting your own printer in, trying to find the file, designing your own, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, and that will that so will that be solely resin printers, or will you also start including the other kind whose acronym is escaping
FDM?
So
I've done a lot of FDM work myself prior to this resin printing bank that we've set up here. So at the moment, it'll be starting with the resin. To be honest, resin is much easier to service than the FDM printers, because you're looking at one axis of movement compared to three. And then you're looking at, you know, the quality of the input of the FDM, rather than with the resin ones, you just have to make sure your laser's doing its thing.
I hate changing the FAP.
So you know, the reality is, you know, there's a lot more that can go wrong in FDM printers. And until I think the technology vastly improves, we're still going to see, well, we're going to see realistically mass improvements of the resin printers into more and more large scale stuff. That's probably the reality of the situation. And a lot of the sculpts that we see these days, especially, so we had Neil Lambis on our very recent long form video that came out, that's coming out, go through some sci-fi miniatures. And, you know, sci-fi used to be, you know, kit bash vinyls, and then it turned into plastic kits during the Star Wars years. But now it's like, well, actually, you know, you want something of the more modern ones, and the only way you're going about that is through 3D printing, because even a lot of injection kits cannot capture the detail, and you're starting to look at, you know, 2-foot pieces of, you know, resin print, and that's great. You know, it's slowly churning out the need for the FDM stuff, because unfortunately it's not very commercial, the FDM side of things. You know, the layer lines, the constant issues and repairing, etc.
Yeah, I guess, like, going along the lines of that kind of like stuff, using printers and stuff, I mean, that can be expanded also towards stuff like, say, silhouette cutters for, you know, custom masking sets that people design themselves, cutting and stuff like that. So it's kind of like, at the moment, once you get that stuff sort of sorted, it's sort of world's your oyster sort of thing.
Exactly. So, you know, there's a lot you can do, you know, with laser cutting, the Cricut machines, and so those die cutters. Absolutely fantastic. And so, you know, this means a lot. You know, you don't have to wait. Like for RC cars, you know, you're talking previously having to kind of find the right guy that does print a good vinyl. Whereas with the die cut machines, laser engravers and cutters, you know, you're talking about being able to, you know, grab your own stencils and start talking about, you know, having the patterns on the inside of the shell rather than have to, you know, put on vinyl decals on the outside, which is a massive game changer. That'll happen very shortly within the RC world as well. Yeah. So, yeah, technology is making real change, but it's like the rest of these hobby stores. You know, nothing is just selling a box anymore.
Yeah, and that's the thing. It's like if you can be the first one to offer that amount of services, you know, then that's going to be fantastic sort of thing. I just wanted to touch on your short and long form content. So you've called it a podcast for the Northland Hobby Store sort of thing. Yeah. Tell us a bit more about that, like what your plans for that are. There's going to be a way to reach out to, you know, a lot of New Zealand audiences, I think. Yeah.
I think it's important to realize there's actually like a lot of very interesting people around the hobby scene. You know, that these are people, the crowd that does hobby comes from a very far field, you know. So we have a lot of very interesting people actually, even in New Zealand. And so you're trying to capture them all is very important, but also starting to layer up skills as well and get that on there. So at the moment, our first two long-form videos for the podcast have been with Mark Peacock, who was an FX magazine editor and currently is part of a aircraft book publishing company. Forgot the name of is at the moment. But people like him,
yep.
Yeah. So yeah, people like him have a massive impact on the hobby, and he actually runs, you know, school programs for model building for kids out this way. And so you know, getting conversations with him is very important to capture that knowledge, to capture, you know, the understanding of, you know, how much, you know, the previous model world worked, as well as anchor points into the modern generation. Our recent one was with Neil Lambis, who's a big sci-fi guy. And so for him, he goes through, you know, the very backbones of, you know, what sci-fi modeling looks like. And for us, it's, you know, a very different world if you've done compared to Militaria and war games and so forth. And so, you know, sci-fi kits are, you know, very different. Again, lots of vinyl, lots of like things that you can't paint properly because the paint just doesn't work. and, you know, we capture those kind of people, and then like, you know, capturing the videos on how we do specific techniques and things that are very much a lost art. You know, there's hobby magazines, you know, White Dwarfs and old FX magazines that used to be all over how to kit bash and how to do basic weathering techniques, etc. And all these things and these magazines and these articles are still all very relevant, but, you know, unfortunately with that kind of print, unless you can find an old copy, it's very hard to get hold of these days. And, you know, we're trying to bring this back in as well. You know, how do we capture things that are very important technique-wise, story-wise, and kind of bring it back up to an archivable level that can feed the situation, the hobby scene, and the hobby itself going forward with every aspect, you know, because, you know, for us, we do a lot of, you know, RC car stuff, trains, hot war games, hobby kits, And so these all actually feed to the same thing where, you know, it's all just very much the similar hobby. But we can't let this knowledge kind of go to waste. But also be able to bring it into a, you know, a modernized format where, you know, we've got, you know, the younger generations being able to access it and learn from it.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I always say it's like the COVID was probably like one of the best things for the hobby because it's like, it's like our IPMS club brought in so many like younger members who like got into Gundam.
Mm. And, fantastic.
Yeah. And, you know, from they started, you know, attending our IPMS shows and our club meets and stuff, and they've, you know, a lot of them's branched out to doing more sci-fi stuff or more armor or got into aircraft and even cars. So, I mean, it's...
Yeah. Yeah.
The hobby's out there with the younger generation. I like to think that COVID is what made it happen. If there's one good thing that came from that.
That's a really good point, though. Because, you know, a lot of people say, oh, this and that about, you know, what it did for the retail stores. But, you know, for the back end of the hobby, it was really fantastic. And, you know, we're now, you know, starting to build more and more model clubs in schools. And so we'll be approaching that down model there as well. You know, how do we get model building on board? But, you know, there's a few giant tragedies that happen between that. For instance, the Boy Scouts in New Zealand recently dropped model making as one of their badges. Now it's like part of an arts and crafts badge, a generic one, where it's like, well, actually, you know, it is, model building is actually a very traditional hobby with its own, you know, its own stretch and stream of history and techniques and differences that, yeah, it's there's a lot of work to do to kind of get this going right again. But we're in the right place. We've got the right technology, got the right people talking to us, and, you know, we've got the opportunity here to take these risks and to move things forward. And I think that's what it is as well, you know, because, you know, we are going to have to, you know, go out there, you know, start talking to these groups and, you know, saying, well, you know, we want to rebuild it, do you?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm-hmm. So, like, say with Northland and Model Air, doing stuff like, say, holiday programs and stuff like that, is that something that you'd be, like, sort of tentatively looking into, like, how to get kids into, you know, once you get them hooked, you know, that's their money gone for their entire life. but I think,
yes,
like that's sort of the bit, that's sort of the way to try and get the younger, because a lot of the sort of, you know, a lot of kids don't have, you know, parents who grew up with modeling. You know, we've got these new generations coming through with generation, whatever the new one is. I'm not sure we don't like them, but. You know, but they've got younger parents and they weren't, you know, there was sort of a generation that missed out on modeling and stuff like that. So, you know, you get these kids who doesn't have a dad who grew up modeling and stuff like that. So, you know, sort of doing workshops and stuff like that would probably be the better way for getting younger kids into modeling, and doing it at a local store is probably one of the better places for it as well.
Absolutely. So we actually, the old counters in both locations, we've actually just chopped down to public workbenches purely for that reason. And then, you know, like I said, we'll be going to schools and starting to do school clubs and so forth and really drive it hard. You know, it's a big reason as to why, you know, the train scene really suffers is because a lot of the older people in those train scenes, there's a story up here where they wouldn't let anyone under 50 join one of the train groups.
Gatekeeping. Major gatekeeping.
Yeah. Which is horrific, you know.
Yeah.
You know, oh, I don't want kids with their sticky fingers touching my models. It's like, well, actually, get your ice cream covered fingers to touch my models. That's great. Like, the whole thing is tactile. And as much as, like, okay, computer games are out there, but the reality is, like, when you have, you know, an RC tank rolling around shooting BBs at other RC tanks with infrared sensors on them, blowing smoke and things like that, you know, video games drop pretty quick compared to that. And so you know, making all of these, you know, are just more involved. And this is why, you know, I find RC, war games, etc., very important because, and why you can't shun them, is because they're that little bit extra of what you do with your model after you've built it, you know. And so, yeah, you can have a million models on your wall, but it's also, you know, bringing more, you know, tactile, more involved sense into the hobby as well.
Yeah, absolutely.
Something I wanted to ask real quick, David, is have you guys thought about doing a model contest at all for your stores?
Absolutely, it's on our radar. And for us right now, it's just we have so much going on. Not to mention we're right on Christmas' door. So,
oh yeah,
we're just trying to fend off what we can, and obviously build up model air. But yeah, you know, get contests and start, you know, being relevant with it. You know, war games have always been great, and hey, you know, you just add a tournament and all of a sudden, like, it becomes meaningful. And so, yeah, the whole, like, competition, an out-of-box competition, which is fantastic, or just, like, period competition, is a great ways to, you know, obviously sell kits for us, but also just get that general involvement in there. But, you know, and adding on from that, like, yeah, okay, well, a kid comes in and just buys a kit. Like, they, you know, their parent looks confused and worried, oh, I don't know what to do next. And you don't start your conversation off, oh, you got to do all these things and this. They say, you know, well, there's some basics and then there's the next step and the next step. But look, you know, you're surrounded by professional expert hobbyists here. We can, you know, we've got our workbench open. We can get you involved that way. You can start talking to the specific clubs and groups. And this is why you build school groups. You get these little supports built up in the right places. And then what you really want at the end of the day is sponsored contests. So we are as a hobby store, not directly running them, but indirectly sponsoring it and pushing it up, where you've got the different support structures around you, as well, saying, hey, well, this is what's happening here, this is what's happening there. And so, you know, that separation a little bit, and these, you know, different pillars of support structures, as well as us being a layer over top to sponsor that and really bring it together, is very important.
Yeah, right on. I think stuff like, say, store group builds and stuff like that would be a great idea for getting people in, because, you know, you have like the winner, and the winner is on display in the window, and everyone can see it and admire it. And, you know, I know like Garrison, you've got a model in a hobby, you know, on display in a model store, and
I do
stuff like that. And, you know, and have that ability of like, hey, here's, everyone can see, not on a photo, but the real thing in real life, what they've built. You know, it just adds that little bit of extra layer and a little bit of a community-based sort of thing.
Absolutely. And you know, as modelers and the model groups around us, you know, they all want to pitch their models in, which is great, into the store. And so, yeah, being open to be able to accept that. Because the problem is that, you know, a lot of stores get real stodgy. Oh, I don't really want to display this. You know, we've only got, you know, so much room. And so you have to be aware of, obviously, your display, but also, you know, you can just cycle it and make sure people understand and give them a bit of a store credit if need be and run things like that. But, yeah, you know, it's building interest. Like, you see something. Like right now, I can see a plane in my display case that was built by a customer, and you know, I can see that the triangles are off. It's doing my head in, but you know what? It's fantastic to, you know, have that visualization there for people to see that kind of stuff, what's being worked on at any level, which is really great, you know. And, you know, that person might come in and see it and talk about it, and they might be, you know, I really do want to fix that next time. Oh, you know, that's important, you know, because, you know, they're building their own hobby as well. And, you know, and this reaches to all levels, not just, you know, school kids, because, you know, we've all got little bits and pieces here and there with our own hobby that do need improving. Not being shy about it, you know. Absolutely.
Hey, yeah. You sure you don't want to come to the States to Wichita, Kansas, and run the store here?
One day, maybe. No. Get the death stare from my partner.
I think we could almost hear that one.
All jokes, all jokes. Don't kill him, please.
Now, there is kind of a downside about also displaying stuff. I know it's like around here, it's like we do have a college around here, so we get some, you know, loonies that come into the local hobby store every now and then. But there was, I'm not sure what scale it was now, but it was a nice bust. And the guy who painted it, he is excellent when it comes to, you know, painting, you know, realistic looking flesh tones and stuff. Mm-hmm. And it was a Wehrmacht machine gunner, and it was, you know, like from a little below the neck up, and there was no like offensive markings or anything, but you could tell it was German. And this girl came in and went absolutely ballistic and was like threatening like to bust open the display cabinets and stuff and break it and break it.
Far out. It's really hard. I think a lot of people, and I've had my share of those crazies just in general life, and doubly so when it comes to wargaming, because now all of a sudden you're playing with the bad guys as well. And what it comes down to is, look, we're not like, you know,
glorifying.
Thank you. Glorifying the subject in front of us. You know, this is us reenacting history just to say that this happened and for people to be aware of it. You know, it's not us trying to push any idealism onto anyone of anything. You know, we're not political in any degree when it comes to our hobby. And, you know, it's the idea that these subjects just should be available, be looked at and talked about. And, you know, one of the big things obviously is, you know, swastika on in German aircraft, cigarette brands on race cars, you know, these all slowly have been disappearing. And in actual fact, you know, it's great to see that kind of livery because, you know, you understand the historical importance of, you know, why it was there and what it actually meant. And it's not glorifying it at all, you know. And so how do we go about it? You know, it's very just important to say to these people, look, someone's got to play the bad guy.
Yeah.
They didn't exist. They didn't not exist, you know. And very much that, the non-glorification of it. You know, it's just, you know, as all museums have done forever, you know, these things just exist and it's important to recognize them. And so we try our hardest, you know, in all these situations to make sure, you know, that that's aware of it. Yeah. And the people, you know, that get political about it, where you tell them, look, this is, you know, this is not a political hobby or store. This is not a political game. This is not a political anything, you know. This is just what it is. It's history in front of you.
Facts. Exactly.
So just a quick circle back to say, like, the competitions and stuff. So, you know, with, say, help with that, would you be looking towards, say, volunteers, you know, to help run sort of, like, parts of the store for you, like, you know, competition, that sort of thing?
Yeah, absolutely. You know, I mean,
like, I'll something like that, I would happily, like, raise my hand up to help out a store because, you know, But there are a lot of people within the model community that would happily, you know, give up some time to help out with that kind of stuff. Is that, like, would you be looking at towards, like, say, a call to arms on that kind of thing, and be receptive to get a whole lot of feedback from people to see, like, what people are looking for and stuff like that?
Absolutely, because I mean, we don't know every part of the aspect of every part of hobby. In an individual, you know, even, you know, as a store, when we buy in product, I can't lean on just myself. You know, I don't know enough about cars, you know, whereas my partner Renee is very good at, you know, what do classic cars and JDM look like that will sell. She knows that world really well. We need to find train people to give us more insights there. And so very much, you know, when we want to run competitions, war game tournaments, anything like that, you know, we do need to reach out and, again, get the community involved to say, hey, we've got the space, we've got the ability to do this thing. But, yeah, we do need that, obviously, expertise top end, you know, to make sure that everything's on an even playing field and we're not just, you know, going off, you know, a small segment of expertise to find these winners. And so, yeah, absolutely, putting a hand out saying, you know, we do need the community involved. We'll help the community and do what we can, and community driven, and then a little bit needs to come back from the community. How do we actually, you know, get this expertise involved and up front as well? And very open to that. And so, yeah, absolutely, mate.
All right. I just want to ask my other co-host, do they have, before I ask one last question from me, do they have anything else they want to ask, David?
Yes. What resin printers did you say you was using at the moment?
So we're using AnyCubic Mono 6Ks.
Okay, yeah, that's a nice printer.
Yeah, fantastic. So we had some other ones that we were looking at, but they were recently end of life. So, yeah, we got these ones in. Fantastic prices, I must say. They just run out of the box, put the resin in, chuck your print on, and it just pops out. And it's fantastic.
And it's like the resin printing thing, it's been blowing up, and it just keeps... I mean, it's just like every year, it's like it becomes better and better. It's like I started with the original Alugo Mars, and it's like I got a Alugo Saturn now, and it's and even though it's just the first gen, I think they're on Gen 3 now of the Saturn. It's just like, it's like, how can they keep, you know, improving this? I mean, but they do, and the technology is just going to keep getting better there.
Better and cheaper, and so that's important.
And your company that you said you're partnering with to make your sculpts, are they kind of like Hero Forge?
No, so this is Flytrap Digital. So find them on Facebook. So this is Anton Decourt. He's done a lot of work prior for Battlefront Miniatures, a bit of work for Weta and so forth. And so his work's absolutely fantastic. I wish I could bring it up right now and show you. But anyway, have a look for Flytrap Digital. And we're going to be doing, to be honest, we're going to be changing a lot of the landscape on how digital sculpting works going forward.
Okay.
All right. I've got one question for you, David.
Yeah.
What is your personal absolute favorite thing to model?
Like, oh, my personal favorite thing to model. I really like Russian World War II airplanes.
Nice. Very nice.
I was talking about that I-16 before, and that's just fantastic. And there's a few other kits that I really like. One that I'm trying to get through at the moment is a PE-2, and I've done a fantastic LA-5. And a big problem is, you know, these are, unfortunately, Zeds for kits, Russian kits, and we just can't get them. It's really sad. And, you know, modern Zeds for kits, you're looking at the same quality as Tamiya. They're just fantastic, you know, motor detail and cockpit detail and pilot detailing. Oh, but It's the way of the world, so I'm just going to have to sit that for a little while longer before the new ones come out again.
Now, how much is that is like the custom side of thing, or is it more a distributor thing? Or how does
I'm it sorry, work? Say that again?
Like the ability to like to try to get hold of like new kits. I know Callum says, you know, it's hard for to get a whole new stuff there in New Zealand. Is that like strictly a distributor thing, or is that like a customs thing as well, or a mix between the two?
It's really a mix between the two. We've got a bit of a funny law around spray paints coming into the country, so that doesn't help. We've got a funny taxation law around $1,000 limits, import limits. We've got distributors that, you know, struggle to understand the market appropriately.
A bit like Airfix.
Yeah. I mean, Airfix is fantastic and terrible at the same time. You know, they've done their Lysander that's coming out. And from a hobby store perspective, this is fantastic. 148 Lysander. We haven't seen a 148 kit forever to show an early war British ground attack aircraft. And so that's great, but then you see, you know, their redo of the 124 P-51, which is just a bit of a slightly new tooling, but everything is ancient and terrible.
Yep.
David, out of curiosity, you mentioned that New Zealand's got some kind of a spray paint kind of customs thing coming in. Are you guys also losing access to Tamiya spray paints? Because in Canada, that same, I guess, law, you could call it, is being passed. You can't import Tamiya spray paints anymore.
Yeah, I'd say so. Maybe it's a bit tougher there in Canada. I mean, we've still got the accessibility, and it's still coming in slowly in drips and drabs, and we have enough content to cover the market. But, you know, there's actually the other brands that we're really having problems with. Tamiya seems to be the least of our concerns. At least that supply seems okay, but it does seem to be the back end laws around it seem to be similar as new, where to get the shipment in, ultra restrictive, 3-month delay, oof, not good. What do we do about it? Well, I don't know. We push forward. We rely on modern technologies. So the cheap airbrushes that you can get off AliExpress and so forth, we've actually invested a bit into getting those in store. And we go, well, look, we can't exactly get the sprays that we want, but we can get cheap airbrushes in. We can show people how to use them. We can, you know, start getting people working up on airbrushes instead, and you know, maybe that's the way forward. And I guess until they somehow put some kind of ban on, you know, mobile air pump batteries or something, then there's, you know, technology that comes out. And you know, I've just been talking to my distributor around these cheap airbrushes, and the next one that we're looking at is absolutely fantastic. It's got the lower pin trigger on it. It's got the third setting of speed is absolutely phenomenal at its output. And these are all gravity fed, and you're looking, you know, under 100 New Zealand dollars to get these kind of airbrushes to people. And, you know, so at the end of the day, it's like, well, that's not fantastic, but this is also, you know, old hat. Old industry, we've just got to change it.
I don't know if you can get hold of like gallery airbrushes there. I know they've been blown up here within the last year or so. It's like I got one. I think Garrison did too. And
yep,
it is just as nice as my Water Eclipse.
Yeah, well,
I mean, I'm blown away by it.
We can actually. So they are available. I do need to put that on my radar a bit more. But yeah, they're available here. We just need to find the right people. But that's okay. We'll get there. Like I said, I've got a team. We can move fast, and yeah, when we see the availability at a reasonable availability, we'll be able to jump on it.
Excellent. All right. So I've just got one more question before we round things up. So coming into the new year, what can we look forward to with Northland and Model Air? What are the sort of immediate things we can expect? Or is that still a little bit of a hush-hush secret?
No. That's so the big thing with Model Air is that we really want to push, obviously, full-time hours again, 5 days a week. Minimal kind of thing, absolutely, and then from there a lot of social media, I've talked a little bit about RC tanks, so there's a lot of work that can be done to rebuild. The previous RC tank market was dominated heavily by Tamiya. Those don't exist, and that's the reality again. Old industry, so we've got new makes, Henlong. And they're fantastic. There's now the ability through 3D printers, maybe we make figures, 116 figures to go with these tanks. And then we've got obviously segue onto our printing service and our digital sculptor. What does it look like for us to be able to get kits of anything? Wink, wink, World War II.
All right. Well, thank you, David, for coming onto the podcast. I just want to say that after this conversation, I am beyond excited to see what's going to happen to my favorite model store. You're doing what is essentially for us God's work.
Amen.
For us, the whole hobby stores dying out and all of that. Well, you hear the stories of people hanging out, and that's what we want. We don't want to have to do everything online. We want to be able to go to stores. We want to go and meet people.
Exactly.
And all of that. And you're basically revitalizing the ability to do that. So for me, that is like the biggest, fucking thank you in the world for what you're doing. Hopefully I'll be able to catch you in the store and, meet you in person and all of that. But yeah, I just wanted to say big thanks for what you're doing and big thanks for coming on and talking to us about it.
Yeah, no, thank you guys, and thanks for inviting me. It's like I said, it's important. The social media aspect now is phenomenal, and I'll quickly talk something more again. When we approached Northland Hobby, we said, well, what does marketing look like? Well, we said, we can just hand out a bunch of flyers, we can put up some radio ads. That doesn't work. And so what we've driven is purely social media. It's a cost-effective solution. This is what does work. There will be some, obviously, avenue for more traditional media as well. But, it's important that the podcasts exist, the expertise are archived, the conversations are listened to and talked about.
Absolutely. Well, big thanks from me and the crew for coming on. That was Absolutely. David Mulder, revitalizing a couple of model stores. So big thanks to him. We are going to head into a brief intermission, and we will be back with the usual hobby news, works in progress, all of that. However, you might have heard a very familiar face, familiar voice crop up just before, which is Dennis, who hasn't been on in a while. So I think before hobby news, we might do a little bit of a interrogation.
Here we go.
But
it's well earned.
But until then, so brief intermission, then we'll get back into all of that. But once again, big thanks for David for coming on the podcast, mate. You're amazing.
Thanks David. Guys.
Thank you.
And we are back with the hobby news. But before we get back into the hobby news, Dennis, where the fuck have you been?
Working. Contributing to society.
Boo.
Shareholder value. Yeah.
Yeah, boo. Yeah. Who contributes to society?
Go be a menace to homeless like me.
I should be. That sounds like it, the right plan.
Does this mean you'll be on for a few more episodes at least?
Oh, a couple more at least, that's for sure, yep.
Good.
Until we get back to the old school thing, and then we'll see then. But yeah.
How many years of school have you got left?
I've got about one, so I'm going to be graduating this time next year, actually. If all goes to plan,
thank
don't fail.
God.
Yeah.
Nice.
Yeah, I couldn't come soon enough.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Well, also means that you might have to host an episode or two to make up for that fact.
I could talk a little about cars now, actually, which is kind of weird. But yeah, I definitely need to write some stuff up. Definitely built some neat models, seen some cool things in the time I've been on my hiatus. And good to be back, though.
Well, it is great to be back, mate. All right. Now that we got the sappy soft stuff out the way, we're in with the hobby news. And first up, we have from IBG Models in 72nd scale. They're bringing out a Gotha Go 244.
Ooh,
this weird looking aircraft is a twin engined, twin boom cargo aircraft. Originally started life as a glider. However, they decided to slap on two engines onto it. And basically, it's a miniature ME 323. Same with the 323 Gigant, which is just a giant glider. This is like the baby version of it. So, as you can see, it's a very rudimentary looking aircraft. But I would absolutely love to have one of these because they are so cool.
Very.
Yeah, very.
Also,
nice.
that CAD rendering looks pretty nice as well. From Hobby Boss in 48 scale, we are having a Challenger 2 British MBT. Hobby Boss has been releasing a whole bunch of 48 scale, which make quite a few people... There's actually more 48 scale modelers for armor than you think. We just call them weird, but...
Why not 172? Come on.
Why not 35th? Come on.
There's a few good kits of the Challenger 2. In 35th scale, so you got to throw a bone to the 48 scale guys once in a while, you know.
Fine.
And, Challenger, the Chelly 2 is also a very cool tank. So
it is.
Know.
It is.
Up next from Hobby 2000 in 32nd scale, they are releasing. Well, this is more of a new parts. A 32nd scale Focke-Wulf 190 D9 early production. This kit also comes with resin parts made by Ares. Primarily, they're the resin parts for the nose cowling and the nose guns, which I'm sure a lot of people would be very very thankful for. I got to say, the D9, the Dora 9 series of Focke-Wulfs are probably my favorite, just because I think they look way better than a standard short-nosed Focke-Wulf. So D9, of course... turned into the TA-152?
Yeah, I believe that's it.
Close enough. But, yeah, for anyone with this, of course, Hobby 2000 do rebox basically every kit they have. But don't worry. This is basically just a reboxing of a Hasegawa kit. So, could be good. Don't know.
I've seen the Hasegawa's built up very nicely.
I've only built one Hasegawa kit, and it wasn't that good, but it was an old Hasegawa, so...
The bad thing about these, even their 32nd scale ones, though, if it's Hasegawa, they don't have rivet detail.
Ooh, really?
Yeah, they're just panel lines, if you're lucky.
It's big enough you can actually sort of sort that out yourself. I mean, it doesn't look like it's too bad in the old rivet line, so...
Yeah,
I think this would be one to look out for. Plus, it's got a pretty cool camo scheme on it. Next up, from St. George Model in 35th scale. Of course, St. George are a bit like Vargas, you know, resin kits, and they're do all these eclectic stuff. And for this one to be released in 2025, we have a 24cm SKL-40 Theodore Karl. This is a 24cm rail gun. This is a limited edition one they're bringing out. I don't know how it's limited edition, but all I know is this is really cool. And the fact that it's in 35th scale for a 24 centimeter cannon, that thing is absolutely ginormous. And it'll be amazing to build, I bet. That'll look cool.
I want this to go with my Leopold.
Oh, yeah. Yep. Yeah, this thing. Definitely want to have a bit of track, have it sitting on a bit of track with the gun up and all of that. So, yeah, that thing's got to be at least a foot long.
Now, was this a German one or was this a Czech-made Skoda?
Not too sure. The only thing I can think of is the fact that it's got SK before the L40. Could stand for Skoda, but I don't really know German naming.
All right, now this is probably World War One though. Never mind. So this looks probably more like a German naval gun from World War One.
Ah, right. Okay.
Either way, I still want it.
Yeah. Either way, it looks so cool. Up next from Border, they've been drinking way too much vodka because they are bringing out an Apocalypse Tank version 2. This weird Cold War futuristic Soviet what the fuck Red Alert 2 thing.
Looks like the tank from Fallout 4.
It probably is. So we have this Apocalypse tank. It's got four sets of tracks, two on either side. You know, they're sort of a bit like the Scorpion from Halo. You got some Dozer blades in the front. You got a turret with two cannons in it and some giant mortars on the side. Will it be a seller? Don't know. Don't know if it will be well received or not. I don't know.
Well, the interesting thing with this is actually it comes with LED lighting as well, I believe. So you can light up the interior.
Okay, sold. I want one. I'll take that. That makes it cool. And also, if it comes with the figure, the guy holding the vodka.
That would be cool.
Yeah. It seems like it is also a snap kit, just reading the paint-free and cement-free signs on the box. So I think, you know how people do those German fucking 1946 weird shit? This would just be Soviet 1946 weird shit.
Nah, bro, this is HIDF all the way.
Hell yeah. From AK Interactive, they are releasing two T2 model commercial vans. We have the 1967 public service van. This comes with a Red Cross livery, probably for some ex-Soviet country. I don't know, Balkans, I guess. Don't know, but also a 1972 version, a commercial van, which has a very interesting teal-colored Elvis AEG. Looks like, God, what's the teal-colored power tool? Is it Makita?
Oh.
Hitachi.
About to say, my brother in Christ.
Milwaukee? Jeez, man, come on.
Do not disrespect them like that.
But either way, this sort of Soviet combi-looking van would probably make a decent, post-apocalyptic diorama, Soviet, I don't know.
Now, I do have a question about this.
Yeah?
On the commercial van on the right, is it sitting in front of Chernobyl?
I was going to say, it would be a great Chernobyl diorama.
Possibly. I mean, hey, you do you, mate. Next from AFV Club, in 35th scale, we have a Wiesel, the Waffenträger Wiesel 2 MELS, which is stands for, I am not pronouncing that because that has at least 100 letters in it.
It's Javelin 2.
Basically, so yeah. We have a Wiesel 1 with an airborne anti-tank armored vehicle with a Javelin 2, did you say?
Well, no, I mean, the MELS is kind of like the updated version of the Javelin. It's basically an electro-optically guided fire-and-forget missile. Basically, it's going to be replacing the Spike LR in the Bundeswehr. So, kind of imagine a tow missile lethality married with the Javelin guidance, but with the fire and forget characteristics of the Spike LR.
So, basically, you're just saying it's fucking deadly.
Oh, dude, this thing is crazy.
So,
we send it to Ukraine.
So, some of the new things, because this is sort of a new release just with a brand new part, so I'm counting this as brand new, because I think the original AFE Club Weasel came out in the 2000s. but it has an entirely new MALS launcher and missile, completely new wheel set, freshly designed driver hatch, a recently crafted antenna mount, and totally new car body roll cage. That's what comes on the box, and it does actually have a roll cage, so that's kind of cool. Either way, Weasel, amazing little vehicle, cool little subject. Must have. Up next in the weird and wonderful, we have from Micromare in 72nd scale, a Caproni Type B torpedo boat. This, I tried to do research into this, and it seems like this kind of was like conceptual, but also somewhat real or based off something in real life. Basically, you have a... how do you describe this? You take a section of a wing, you put two propellers and engines in the front, you put the driver in the middle, you put the gunner out sitting out the back of the wing, you put two plane floats on either side underneath the engines, and you put two torpedoes underneath, and somehow that makes it a torpedo boat. It's Italian, I don't know what the fuck, but I want one. This ticks the weird and wonderful box by a large margin, and it's weird but kind of cool. I really want one. This thing's weird.
How did they steer it?
I believe you have
rudders
in the floats, but they don't look too big, so I don't know.
Yeah, so
I feel
tiny.
Like this thing would flip so easily.
Oh yeah, yeah. You might even have a risk of accidentally taking off. I think this is I think it's trying to be a ground effect vehicle. Is it ground effect? Yeah.
I'm going to take a 50 to one of these in real life and see what it does.
Shred it. Either way, I think it looks awesome.
It's definitely crazy.
From Das Werk in 16th scale, we have a brand new tooled SDKFZ-250-1 Alps A. Of course, the 250 is basically the 251 in the winter, as in it's cold. This is in 16th scale.
Shrinkage.
Yeah, just a little bit. So we have workable tracks and suspension, full interior, including an engine, 4 marking options, and the driver figure is included. I know people like, say, Clint would love to have this in their stash.
Yeah, I'm not into 1/16.
Yeah, but it's still kind of cool.
I don't know.
It's
still neat, yeah.
Up next, from Amusing Hobby in 35th scale, we have a Leopard 2 ARC, an ARC
3/4th
generation main battle tank. Dennis,
give it to me right now.
I fuck with it, bro.
So
I'll fuck it straight up.
So what is an ARC, an ARC? Do you know?
You asking me?
I mean, you're the leopard guy.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure this is just the hull of a 2A7, like with some extra armor added on. But I think the main thing they've done here is it's an unmanned turret, kind of like the what the EMBT concept is in the T-14. So they've got a... I think this is still a 120mm gun. Could be wrong on that. 120, I believe it's a 30mm autocannon up on the crow's mount looking thing there. But yeah, it's got trophy. It's basically an unmanned turret with an autoloader. So who makes these? Kraus Maffei, they actually have one of these. This exists in real life. They've done some driving trials with it. If you go on their social media pages, you can actually see some neat videos of it.
All right. Well, at least Amusing Hobby are onto it, getting it out.
Yeah, they're doing some very interesting stuff right now.
And that's it for the hobby news. Fucking Zencaster couldn't have held on for another minute 30, could it?
Nope.
Anyway, so we are now on to our works in progress. And first up is Garrison.
All right, so I've been working on a Falaise Gap diorama. This is what it's currently sitting at, minus the stone walls I've started painting during the episode. Stug's almost done. Building is almost finished. Base painting. I got to do the roof and the wood. And then, so that's the base itself for now.
Very nice.
Thank you. This is the first bit of camo, the first camo tunic and helmet I've finished. I'm really hoping. I followed the guide that came with the Vallejo Waffen SS camo. The one where the dude did the camo on a fucking 16th scale figure. And
then trying telling you how to do things in 35th.
Yeah, I tried. I really did. I'm hoping once everything else is painted and there's a fucking wash on it and it's weathered, it'll do the part. But yeah.
Nah, it's looking good already, mate.
I appreciate it. Then coming up, I got this at the last show, the Soviet T-64 BV Mod 1985 by Trumpeter. It's a very well casted little vehicle.
That looks awesome.
Kit. Oh yeah, dude, it's gonna be such a joy to build. And then got the first resin figure for the new Ukraine diorama. It's holding up a cell phone, and it's a very detailed figure. So. Very nice.
You gonna add a cope cage to that?
I was honestly thinking about it. I'm not gonna lie. I was gonna see what all. I'm gonna get it built up first and see if I could get one 3D printed. Because I know there's been some STLs out there for cope cages. So.
Yeah, just build one yourself. You know, just like out in the field where they're just like, you know, eyeballing it.
I might do that too. We'll see.
Go to the hardware store and look for aluminum window screen. That'd be pretty in scale for 135th.
You're not wrong. You are not wrong. I might do that.
Up next is mine. I finally got my Focke-Wulf 200 C8 Condor finished last night because... Next week, I am off work for 3 weeks, and I just want to clear my bench so I can start with brand new, fresh models, new projects. So I was up to about 10:30 last night working on this one, just trying to get it out there. And now I need to take better photos, but I haven't got my photo area set up properly. So, yeah, it's too big for what I've got right now. You know, problem I've never had in my life. it looks really good on the shelf, and I'm definitely happy to have it finished. I've gone with the discolored heavy chipped Condor that somehow survived more than a couple months in the war, so yeah, I think it's looking good.
Nice.
Very nice.
That antenna array must have been hell to build.
Oh god, how to build the nose didn't have the mark the holes guide holes or anything, so you have to kind of drill them out yourself. It looks weird with the radar. I gotta say, it makes it look like it has a beard.
It does. It has a little beard and goatee.
Yeah. It's a bit weird, but yeah. Nah, it's a good kit to put together though, so yeah.
Right on. All right. We have a current group build going on. It's the World War I group build going until March 1st. I gotta get the updated one. I keep updating. Yeah, it's going to March 1st, so if you want to throw in a previous build for recreational, build one for recreational, or accept the challenge and go for the one and only prize, which is, this is the last group build for the big prize we're doing. Join in. Join the Discord, see what other folks have done, and get after it.
And that brings us to the end of the episode. But before we can end things off, we have to give our special thanks to our Patreon supporters who help keep the lights on around here and make life a little bit easier for us. So they are, as usual, Paul Gallagher, Lord Floki, Robert Judson, Brel Mastroni, Liam Barnett, and our Pinju follower, Robert Brisbane. You guys are amazing for supporting us, standing by us, and all of that kind of thing.
Thank you, lads.
So, we have come to the end of the episode, unless The others have anything else they want to pitch, promote, say, or otherwise?
Good episode. Had a lot of fun. Thank you, David, for joining.
Yeah. Hopefully this all recorded.
Yes, hopefully it recorded.
You're going to give me fucking PTSD. I am definitely going to need some alcohol tonight after all of that. But, of course, we have a big thanks to David Mulder for coming onto our podcast and giving us a very interesting insight into the world of revamping model stores and bringing them into the 21st century. So a big shout out to him. Check him out on Facebook and as well as the two stores, Model Air and Northland Hobbies. One of the reasons we didn't have a model store of the week is because, you know, it'd be kind of insulting. and we just talked about two model stores in depth. So, yeah, kind of made that one a mute point. But all I have to say now is thank you for watching and listening to the Micro Machine Podcast. We thank you from the bottom of our hearts for joining in and supporting us. And we would just like to say we will see you in the next episode. Bye for now.
Deuces. Bye.